Welcome to episode 401 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we're going to debut a new annual effort, a new idea, sort of a best of program. We're calling it some of the best bits and wits of 2020. And we could have chosen so much stuff. It was difficult just to narrow it down, but we did. And we like to thank everybody who was part of this year's set of episodes. Strange year, but nonetheless, we had some good conversation. So here we go. Some of the best bits and wits of 2020 on Troubadours and Raconteurs. Hope you enjoy it.
A hole in my shoe. He took one look at my face and said, I can fix that hole in you. I beg your pardon, I'm not looking for a cure. I've seen enough of my friends in the depths of the gothic blues. And you know that I'm alive. You know that I'm a liar. Nobody helps a liar. Cause I've been down to Cape Town and dropped acid on my tongue. Ripped upon the land till enough was enough. I was a little bit lighter, an adventure on my sleeve. I was a little drunk and looking for company. So I found myself a sweetheart with the softest of hands. We were unlucky in love, but I'd do it all again. We built ourselves a fire. We built ourselves a fire. But you know I. Exactly where I was, there was no snake or cure for unlucky in love. To be lonely is a habit, like smoking or taking drugs. And I've quit them both, but man, was it rough. And now it just makes me tired. Let's build ourselves a fire. Let's build ourselves a fire.
Activist politician Sarah Cruz.
Scranton is 154 years old. The majority of people who have been in leadership at all levels have been men, have been white, have been heterosexual, and have been usually of Eastern European or Western European descent. I am a woman. I am of Latin American descent. I am a lesbian. I grew up also of a low socioeconomic status. And so someone like me has never even come close to running for an elected position or anything where people look up to them for advice or for direction as where to anything in the city should go to.
Yeah, I can see. I can see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
You know, you had to be a trailblazer. and I want to ask you, so what is the significance, do you think, of being young female Latina lesbian as a citizen and as an elected official? Why is all of that together significant?
Well, I think each one of those individual things has its own challenges. I mean, for so long, women have been marginalized. Minorities have been marginalized. Members of the LGBTQ community have been marginalized. And then people who have been of low income have been marginalized. So being all of those things in one person, it's absolutely insane to be a person in the United States, especially now at this time in where we are as a country in 2020. To have to get up every morning and to with the confidence and the self-assurance to just exist as who you are and to live and to survive, not just to survive, but then as an elected official to to be an example to others who may have one or more of those traits or in some way feel like they're also not good enough or they can't make a difference, to be an example to say, yes, you can. And especially within the school district, I mean, we have over 10,000 students. We have close to 20 school buildings. And the majority of those students now are of minority descent, number one, Hispanic. And then close to 80% are also live below the poverty line. And that's why our school district is a Title I school and we get free lunch. And so I thought it was important that somebody who has that lived experience was on the board to bring that perspective to district decisions.
Legendary American journalist and biographer Patricia Bosworth.
My eighth book, and I think it's the most challenging book of my life, and I can tell you exactly what happened, how I came to decide to do it. I was at a meeting with Brian Stevenson, who really created the lynching museum down in Montgomery, Alabama 3 years ago, and he was talking about the importance of paying tribute to the 4,000 Afro-Americans who lost their lives, innocent ones, all of them, for crimes mostly that they never committed. Anyway, I was listening to him talk, and I suddenly remembered that when I was very young, my father and Paul Robeson worked together on an anti-lynching campaign. It was, they were trying to get an anti-lynching law passed in Congress. This is back in the 40s. And I remembered it so vividly. I remembered Robeson coming to our house and talking, and of course he was a phenomenal character, a stupendous kind of heroic, one-of-a-kind characters. And he, you know, the probably the most outspoken advocate for racial equality in his time, and he was also at that point the most famous Afro-American in the world, along with Joe Louis. I mean, he's comparable to Oprah in those days. He was that important and that effective and that influential. Anyway, I decided I was going to write about him and about my father and he fighting to end lynching, and also the fact that they both had bonded because they both were being, at that very moment, they were being surveyed by J. Edgar Hoover. It was, they were both radical and had been doing an awful lot of stuff Hoover didn't approve of, and he was out to get every, what he thought, every communist. My father didn't happen to be a communist. Paul Robeson probably, certainly believed in the Communist Party, although he was not a member of the party. Anyway, all these things kind of converged, and I began to research this book, and that was, I guess I was researching for the last 2.5 years. I now have a contract with Farrar Straus to do it, and I'm just taking the 5 pivotal years of Robeson's life when he was triumphing in Othello on Broadway as an actor opposite Uta Hagen and Jose Ferrer, and at the same time he was working to stop lynching, to get a bill passed in Congress, which, by the way, was never passed and has never been passed to this day. There have been 200 bills that have never passed because of the, you know, the white supremacists in Congress, and there are a lot of them. Anyway, that began my... This is what I'm doing right now, and I'm totally and completely obsessed with the book, and with also with writing about Hoover, which, of course... Hoover is Robeson's exact opposite. You know, it's like good guy, bad guy in a way. You know, Robeson is black and straight and radical, and Hoover is gay and arch conservative and a real villain. And they both looked at justice in different ways. I mean, the whole thing is utterly fascinating, and it will be the most challenging book of my life.
It sounds utterly fascinating, and
it is.
Now, your dad's first name.
My dad's first name was Bartley, or Bartley Crum, and he was one of the lawyers for the Hollywood Ten. He defended Ring Lardner and Waldo Salt and Dalton Trumbo and Bertolt Brecht in front of the first House on American Activities Committee. They were investigating whether or not these guys, all of them writers and or directors, were communists. And they were accusing them of wanting to overthrow the government. I'm laughing, but it wasn't funny.
Poet, musician, expat, and our resident social critic, JQ.
Here's something for you. I read something once that really changed my outlook on things. And it was by an Indian philosopher, funnily enough, a guy named Sri Aurobindo, who was a Bengali and a poet and a spiritualist and all of those things, and a guru at one point, for most of his life. But before that, he was a political revolutionary and a freedom fighter in India. You know, he's very well known in India because if not for Sri Aurobindo, you would have never gotten to Gandhi. He was the guy who was sort of the revolutionary, independence-minded scourge of the British Empire for quite a few years. He said that the nature of suffering is that it is temporary. There is no such thing as permanent suffering. That the greatest metaphysical error ever made was the monotheistic vision of hell, a place of eternal suffering. Suffering is based on temporality. You need time to suffer. what is eternal cannot suffer. In other words, it's limitation. Okay, so if you think of it this way, the reason you suffer psychologically is because you are trapped in your own mind. If you could expand outside of your mind, you would suffer less. Right? This is why the spiritualists speak of expanding consciousness. You go beyond suffering when you get outside of what our consciousness, which is basically mentality, okay, binary thinking. You suffer physically because you are trapped in your own body. If you could feel every cell on earth, you would actually suffer less, because the overwhelming majority of living cells on earth are not in a state of suffering. Suffering is always a state of limitation, whether it be in time or physically. Consciousness is eternality. It is eternity. In other words, awareness can only grow. Suffering is what shrinks you. That there's a sort of yin-yang to that. You follow me?
Totally.
All right. Well, that's sort of to answer to what you were saying about, well, what people are afraid of is not death, for instance, which is just sleep. What they're afraid of is pain, suffering.
Well, let's put it into a pragmatic framework. Let's say someone's really afraid of losing their job because they can't then pay their bills and support their family anymore. How is that going to be transcended through this sort of philosophy, that fear, that pragmatic?
It's not. You're going to suffer. But you're going to suffer temporarily, is the idea. I don't think that can help you. I don't think anything I say or any philosophical idea. You know, it's like Tom Waits says, misery is the river of the world. Nothing has ever prevented suffering. We have notions, and we've been talking about some of them, that life is bigger than this life, that there is something after, something beyond, that what we experience here is a form of illusion or game. You know, and that's a very ancient idea. We were speaking of India. In ancient India, there's two notions of physical reality. Maya, which is that reality is an illusion, and Lila, L-I-L-A, a Sanskrit term, which means that reality is a game, like a video game. So that you're basically a character. And if you've ever played a video game and been in a character, you're very intensely involved. And at the moment, up until the moment where your character, say, gets killed, then you put the joystick down and you're in a greater consciousness than you were in when you were involved in the game, where you narrowed yourself to be that character, if you see what I mean. And so the basic idea is that the life you're living is something like that. Your identity.
JQ here on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. So, you know, do you believe that after your physical self and your consciousness in the form that it is now ends as the way we know it now, and do you hope as well, believe and hope that you're going to go, there's going to be another life for you?
Oh, obviously I'm human. I hope that I expand out of this consciousness into a greater consciousness where everything is more peaceful and loving, and empathy is not a question of understanding what somebody else is going through by comparing it to your own experience, but by experiencing that other consciousness directly and being beyond the ego and selfhood and all of those things. Yeah, and you're in a realm of light and blah, blah, blah. Of course I hope that. Of course. What idiot doesn't hope that, right? But do I believe it? I don't know. Here's the thing. Read your Kierkegaard, one of my favorite thinkers of all time. Faith is the opposite of knowledge. If you know something, you can't have faith in it. Faith is not knowing. So all religion, all spirituality, all these New Age things, or Christianity, Islam, what have you, Hinduism, whatever, it's all faith. It's all based on not knowing. But then again, as a human being, half your experience is objective because you have to deal with the objective world, and the other half is subjective. And I'm sorry to all the philosophical materialists out there, but Occam's razor and the scientific method do not apply to subjective reality And that is half of the experience of every human being, the subjective realm. That's where mysticism and poetry and the arts and religion come into play. Subjective science. And it's tricky and it's paradoxical, but that's the way it is. Voila.
JQ, I think that's a good place to pause our conversation, our never-ending conversation here on Troubadours and Rock On Tours.
Yeah, but my friend, you gotta admit, that's the weirdest one we've had.
I loved it. I think it was wonderful. I'd like to take a special moment to thank our regular contributors, Almighty Todd, Little Star Run, and Dwayne Heisler, for all that you do on Troubadours and Rock On Tours every year. The insight, the kindness, the humor, the intelligence, and the wonderful humanity you help infuse into our program. So greatly appreciated. And I look forward to talking with you again in 2021. Thank you. You're listening to Troubadours and Rock On Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest. Acclaimed New York City visual artist and memoirist Peter McGough.
You know, like anybody, there's their good parts and bad parts. He just wants money all the time.
It's just this,
Who does it?
Exactly. It's great talking with you, Peter. It really is. Peter McGough here on the program, Troubadours and Rock On Tours. I'd like to ask you a question, given your experience with art. How does one know when they are experiencing beauty?
Well, beauty. I mean, you look at a sunset. You're experiencing beauty. You're experiencing the greatest art, nature. I mean, I think any person can look at a sunset, even if they're in the worst mood ever. It can either snap them out of it, or if they pause for a moment in the rage. And, you know, beautiful forests or vistas or the Alps, staring at the Alps. I remember once I first saw the Alps in Switzerland, we were invited by this art dealer, Bruno Bischofberger, to stay with them over Christmas. And, you know, I looked at it and it hurt my eyes. I mean, of course, it was a bright day on those white slopes, but it was just so, it looked like a postcard. I couldn't even wrap my head around it. It was so beautiful. And I think that when you're looking, you know, so nature is complete beauty. You know, it's even a twisted tree, you know, or a little twisted bonsai tree, or a waterfall, or whatever, or the Rocky Mountains. You know, I think that people can really melt into it. And art is very much, either personal, or it's a market, or someone saying, this is really great. You know, there's some people that look at art and they can really understand it. And some people, I think, they look at a price tag. Am I going to flip it? Or some people look at it and think, is this going to go in my house with my furniture? You know, and it's not about the art for the room. It's the room for the art. You know, in my book, I think, not my book, but, you know, my way of thinking is that art, you know, when you read about it, you know, art's about the enemy, art's about antisocial, art's radical, art is all these things like being a murderer or this or that. And I think that people can look at different kind of art and, you know, like when you go to the museum and they say, my kid could do that. Well, your kid didn't do it. And, you know, there's this artist, Bryce Marden, who does these minimalist paintings, like a plain colors next to each other. And people are like, well, I don't know what this means. It's like, well, did you ever meditate? That's what it's like. It's this void and it's beauty at the same time. It's this space that you can connect with instead of something that is, you know, going round and round and round in your head, you know. So I think that beauty, I was told by this printer of photography, he said, what I like about your work, and it's a bad word in the art world, is you're about beauty. And I actually made a painting that said beauty matters. And, you know, before all the this matters and that matters, but I wasn't trying to play off on that, other people's, you know, like Black Lives Matter, which I think is very important. And, you know, so art is about the sublime. Art is about something that's undescribable. You know, I think Pasolini said, if it makes sense, it's not working. You know, the film director. You have to, I think that art is, can reach, you know, the highest ethereal voices of unconsciousness. You know, it can move you to great heights. It can change your point of view. And I think that that for me is what art's about. You know, I go around and I look at the galleries and I'm like, well, that's, you know, that's the current thing. Oh, that's what the young people are doing. Oh, they're really talented draftsmen. Wow, that's really great. Or, oh, wow, it's so big. And then sometimes it's like I'm immersed in their vision and I'm just stunned by it. Stunned by how it moves me. And that's what art, music, books, painting, sculpture, you know, the art. That's why it's so beautiful.
Fiddler, educator, chicken coop builder, and our resident historian, Serf William.
Yes, that, yeah, yes, yeah. Yes. As of last week, right? Because now we are, what's today? March 15th? 14th. Today's March 14th. As recently as last week, it's a Democratic hoax. That's the president of the United States, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, what's the difference between that and the plague, the Black Death is spread by witches or cats or people who are not pious enough? We are in the modern age, the age of science, the age of discovery, and you've got a president who sounds like a religious leader in Florence in the middle 1300s, basically.
Yeah. Good. So, this is the historical perspective and comparison I'm looking for.
Well, I stumbled into it as usual. What we have now that they didn't have in Florence in the 1300s is science. We have science. We actually have people who specialize in studying exactly the problems we're facing right now, using the scientific method, forming a hypothesis, experimenting to determine if your hypothesis is valid, discussing and debating with other learned people about what they're finding and how your results in various experiments compare. That's science. We've had science now for over 2,000 years. It really hit its stride in the Age of Enlightenment, in the Age of Reason. That's when you saw a lot of superstition and a lot of religious beliefs sort of wane, because people were able to, well, they were able to read. They were able to come to some logical conclusions based on evidence, based on what they were witnessing. And we saw great, great strides in the areas of healthcare. And we have a president right now in the modern age talking about Democratic hoaxes, saying things like, no, I'm not going to get tested because I feel fine. So if you want to talk about the history of pandemic, one of the things that you have to talk about simultaneously is people's reactions to those pandemics. And of course, people freak out because you're watching those around you die, and in some cases die rapidly and in great numbers, and you have no explanation for it whatsoever, none. So you start basically grasping for anything you can that's going to bring some reason into an otherwise insane world. And as a result of that, you have people doing things that actually spread the disease even more rapidly. You also have a large group of people who just gave up hope. So the history of pandemic is a history of us not knowing how to deal with these biological phenomena. And today, thank goodness, although we're not immune from these things, we have so many more weapons to fight these things because we have science and technology on our side. Right? And to behave as if a layperson understands how these things work and to discard the information coming from scientists and healthcare professionals, to me, is almost criminal.
Resident punk and one of the co-authors of the highly acclaimed book, The Uncensored Oral History of Punk, Legs McNeil.
We were driving. John said he wanted to start a magazine about comics and rock and roll. And he said, I want to call it Teenage News. And I said, that's a stupid name. Why don't we call it Punk? And they all started laughing. They thought that was a great idea. And John said, I'll be the editor. And Jed said, I'll be the publisher. And they looked at me and they said, what are you going to do? And John said, oh, you can be the resident punk. Ha, ha. You know, he was hysterically laughing. So that's kind of how it started. But we had not seen the Ramones. We didn't even know CBG. I think John knew that CBGBs existed, but I certainly didn't. And I also didn't read rock and roll magazines, you know. I couldn't afford them.
like Cream, for example, that you mentioned.
Yeah, John read them. John read all the rock mags.
Well, you know, the term punk, how did you come up with that? I mean, some people say...
Well, it wasn't that hard. It was, you know, what everybody had called me all my life. You know what you are? You're a punk, you know? You know? And also, they used it on, you know, all the crime shows. You know, when they finally caught the bad guy in the end, they couldn't say, you motherfucker.
FCC legs.
Yeah.
FCC legs.
Or whatever they said, you know. They said, you know, you're a punk. You're a dirty punk, you know?
I got it, yeah.
Playwright, poet, activist, baker and candlestick maker, Kitty Bell Burbank.
Okay. You know, I'm kind of an introvert, so it's different for me, you know, and I've never had the kind of budget where I was going out to eat every night, going to lots of expensive things and going on vacations to faraway places. So none of that is affecting me, you know? So I'm lucky for not being privileged.
You're not spoiled.
On that level. But, you know, I think at first we saw just people sharing whatever resources they had. And we saw that a lot as teachers. Everyone was kind of like, this is what I got. What are you doing? And that's continuing now as we go into the fall. A lot of people just kind of talking about what is your strategy and what are you know, oh, here, let me share this thing that I have with you that I think is going to work, you know, that can help you out. So a lot of sharing and a lot of free theater online that I never would have had a chance to go see before. All the National Theater live shows from London, they're going up one at a time. I saw a Lauren Gunderson play. I saw another public theater production that was actually written for Zoom. So that was really interesting. I got to see a reading of one of my grad school professor plays, and I didn't have to go anywhere. I didn't have to leave my house. I got to do a theater of war workshop that was actually something to do with Greece. And there were like all these famous actors like on my computer screen. It was so cool. I'm like, oh, look, there's Frances McDormand, you know?
Are you, like, and you participated in this program with
yeah, that. I mean, I could have asked them a question if I wanted to. I just listened, but
that's cool.
I got to take a workshop the other day with a New York neo-futurist member. We did I wrote poetry with strangers from all over the world. And it was free. Like, I didn't have to pay anything for that. And I didn't have all those opportunities, you know, in January.
Yeah, you know, it's
our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, if it weren't for these online offerings of free theater, I think he would have offed himself by now. I really do. Because it's such a large part of how he exists, how he gets through. So, you're right. This has been sort of a almost a way of staying connected to the larger world and soothing, nurturing your mind and your soul through the arts. It's so important. And if you can't do it in person, then I guess you got to do it this way. New York City-based director, writer, cabaret critic, and activist, Jerry Geddes.
I mentioned last time an artist that I worked with for a number of years named Robert W. Richards, mm-hmm. who has had a kind of remarkable life of being a companion along with being a wonderful artist in both fashion and in pop culture by being a companion at certain points of Dinah Washington and of Peggy Lee. And through them, he became very good friends with Sarah. And then I became very good friends with Robert. I mentioned the last time he was kind of my Uncle Maine. Mm-hmm. He showed me New York when I was young and just out of Columbia. So I was 20, 21. And so I had seen Sarah a number of times, but he said, "We'll come and we'll hang out with her after." She was playing at the Maisonette, which was a wonderful club in the city in the days of nightclubs. And so we went, and then Sarah invited us. I met her, and I was tongue-tied in the back of the club, just saying how wonderful I thought she was, and she being very gracious, but at the same time very shy, and kind of giggled and said, "Well, thank you very much." And then she invited us up to her suite in the hotel where the Maisonette was. And so it turned out it was just the band, the trio, which was Carl Schroeder, who was a great pianist who I only know from Sarah, but played with many other people. A bass player, Andy Simpkins, and then a drummer, Walter Booker. And they had dates with them. And then it was Robert, Sarah, and me, and we were all kind of sitting on the floor in the living room, just having wine and talking. And at one point there was a lull in the conversation and it was Sarah, then Robert, then me in the circle. And she leaned over and whispered in Robert's ear and he laughed and said, "Oh, sure." So she got up and left. And I leaned over and said, "She was looking at me when she talked to you. What was she saying? Did she want me to leave? What's going on?" And so he said, No. "She just asked if you were old enough that she could bring out the marijuana."
You were 20. You were around 20.
Yeah. And at that point, she appeared in the doorway with a little baggie in her hand and said, "I hear we're all vipers in the room, so let's have some fun."
Excellent.
So we got stoned and talked about music, and it was an amazing evening. And so every time she would come to New York after that, we would hang out. We would go to the Blue Note, and she would rent a limo, and we would sit in the back of the limo, and we would stop by at Gray's Papaya on St. Mark's Place, or 8th Street and 6th Avenue, and get hot dogs. And she'd have bottles of champagne in the back of the car. So we'd have hot dogs and champagne, and we would drive to a place like there was a famous disco called the Limelight that was actually a deconsecrated church that had turned into this big, trendy, gothic kind of disco. And so she never would go in because it was a deconsecrated church, and she thought she shouldn't go into it. Mm. But we would sit outside in the limo and watch the people go in, and she'd be fascinated by the costuming and the energy of all these people going into the club, and we'd just sit there and talk and have hot dogs in the back of the limo watching people go in.
She sounds fun.
Yeah. One of my favorite times, she was playing at Blues Alley in Washington, and Robert and I went down for the weekend to stay with her at the apartment where they had put her up for the weekend. And she made a mean chili, so after the show she made us dinner, and then Sarah traveled with a sewing machine, and her relaxation was sewing. So Robert and I would sit on the couch and have champagne and talk about music with her, but all the while she was at the sewing machine sewing away. Just keeping her other parts of her life up going. So, and she would give me hints of like saying, she would call me and say, you know, I'm singing the national anthem at the Mets game tomorrow, in case you wanted to listen to it or tape it or do something like that. And she would let me know what she was appearing on an album that wasn't in her own name, so I could keep track of those kinds of things. And we were friendly and friends, and she was a wonderful person, very shy off stage.
Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Martina Majok.
The experience you had when you were a kid watching your mom try to make it, quote unquote, did it and does it still inspire you to kind of make it, quote unquote? And do you think you have?
I think that there, like, a part of my DNA is that you are never safe. Like, I joke with my husband, who grew up similarly, although he grew up in a rural, like, in the rural version of that, that, like, we have, like, poor kid mentality and, like, poor kid DNA, which is also, you know, for some people, like, immigrant DNA of, like, there is nothing guaranteed for you. You have no safety net. And so you better make it work, because there's no guarantee that you're going to get helped by your government, by the country that you're in. You know, your family might love you, but they might not necessarily be able to support you financially in other ways beyond love. And so, you know, I don't know if I asked my mom if she felt like she made it, I'm curious what she'd say, because I think that's also, like, the term making it is relative also. Some people think making it is like you have a home, you have a roof over your head, you have healthy kids, and, like, that's a version of making it. Some people think making it is like leaving a legacy of work or writing, you know, in my case, or whatever. But so, yeah, that's also related to the pandemic too. I think people, a lot of people are reevaluating how they've found meaning in their lives and what they define as making it, particularly when, like, so many things are vulnerable and moving and the ways that they have found meaning are not guaranteed at this, you know, moving forward. So, yeah, my mom inspires me all the time. I still, like, find her in my writing, and she's my, like, best friend in the world. I love her so much. But I think, like, that's part of our, shared, like, my inheritance from my mom is, like, take care of yourself. There's no guarantee.
Yeah, I hear you.
Sociologist, historian, activist, founder and CEO of the Black Scranton Project, Glynis Johns.
To an extent, I think Black Lives Matter always, and, like, always, Black lives will always matter. And I think that's important to, like,
hallelujah,
continue to,
yes,
remind people.
Yes.
And I also think, I just felt like people were coming to Black Scranton and being like, what are you doing? What are you protesting? And, like, behind the scenes, I'm sitting here talking to the mayor, talking to Police Chief Graziano, talking to the school board, because I want to now see the city, you know, have our backs. I want to make sure the schools aren't overlooking Black children and continuing the school to prison pipeline. I want to make sure Chief Graziano and his staff of police officers in Scranton City are not unjustly targeting Black people. And I want to know them, and I want to hear them say that. And I want to see it in writing, and I want to see it in legislation. So while everyone is out in the streets protesting, Black Scranton is actually doing, like, you know, doing the legislative work, trying to make sure we have receipts for the action that people are in the streets for. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so, again, protests are very needed, but, like, we're protesting so that we all know the things that we want. So it's like, hey, we need to defund the police. So meanwhile, Black Scranton is like, let me see what the police budget is, okay? And so I'm trying to see how we're spending our money.
It's not
so
just
that
rhetoric.
Way, because I see why is the police budget up $4 million more in their ammunition budget, but the school district still has a deficit of 12 million. You know what I'm saying? These are the questions we should be asking. And so when I was saying, like, there's other ways to protest, you could do protesting by doing research, asking questions, calling your local legislators, knowing who your city council members are, because representation is important. And if you don't even know who represents you, but you want to be in the street and standing in front of City Hall, but you don't know the people who work in there, that's a problem right there. And so I wanted to make sure my city knew that, because again, we can't have action. We can't, like, no one is going to take us seriously. Like I said, if you don't even know who all five members of your city council are, but you're out there, you know? So it's like, I wanted to remind my community that, like, hey, these are important. So while you're mad at me and Black Scranton for not organizing a protest, we want to see what laws are on the books. And so, like, that's why I say, like, there's all different types of action. Like, we need people that want to do the investigative research, want to look at the budgets. We need the people that will be in the streets and remind them that we're still about the action. We need people, like calling the school department, calling the school district and seeing what's up, making sure that, okay, you know, because of COVID, all the kids are getting Chromebooks now to do their work online, but do all the kids have access to internet, and which kids don't? And most of the time it's the students of color. So that's the work that needs to be done for Black Lives Matter. And I think in NEPA specifically, like I was saying, I noticed there was a lot of white people, a lot of white allies that were desperate to get involved in a protest. So that way they can just, you know, check off on their list of, I am not racist, that I participated in a protest, and then they can go about their days and act like everything's totally fine and normal. No, it's not. Like, it's really not. So yeah, I just want to make sure that people remember that it's more than the protest. When you go home and you untie your sneakers and take off your mask, it's more to it. You know, there's still people every single day. The police are still driving up and down the Black neighborhoods still to this day. The police are still, like, targeting Black people still. And it's like, we need to like stand up for that, and we need to continue to make sure that that changes.
Brooklyn-based comedian and comedic writer Nash Rose.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like every other Black person and non-Black person at this point about it is just, it's exhausting. It's not surprising. I don't know if I'm being a pessimist, but I didn't actually expect them to give her justice.
You're talking about Breonna?
Hopeful. Yeah, Breonna Taylor. I was hopeful that they would give her justice, but I didn't expect it to actually happen. So I feel like because of that, I'm not as far in the deep end emotionally as a lot of my friends and friend of friends are. But the whole situation, you know, it's just exhausting.
I guess it pays to be. It pays to be a skeptic then, I guess. You're not so disappointed when things occur that are unjust. But I guess you don't want to become cynical, right?
Yeah.
Now...
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't know. I don't really know how to describe it. It's just something that is normal in my world. So you hope for a change. And if a change happens, that's when you're happy. That's how I see it.
Yeah. So lower your expectations so you're not so devastated and disappointed about, your country, basically.
I think that's what I personally did. Now, I know everyone isn't like that. Like, my sister isn't, my brother isn't, my friends. A lot of my friends aren't there. They go into every single situation with high expectations and hopeful. But I think, you know, and I just realized right in this moment, I think I legitimately traumatized by it, because I remember how devastating Trayvon Martin's case was for me. And that was the last time I allowed myself to get so emotionally invested in these style murders.
And that was years ago.
Yeah, that one hurt too much. That one, and then Eric Garner, so close. And it was just like, those are the two that I was just like, you know what, I can't pay attention to this with all of my heart anymore. It just hurts to the core.
award-winning British music journalist and editor, Alan Jones.
After everybody'd left, we stayed at the table and he ordered a bottle of brandy. And he basically had nothing to do until that night's show. So I had it to myself, really, for about 3 or 4 hours. And although I didn't have a tape recorder with me, and I didn't want to turn what was actually just a conversation into a formal interview, because I thought he might become a bit more guarded. But it was great, just a wealth of stories about Andy Warhol, the factory, touring with the original Velvet Underground. I mean, it was just a fantastic experience.
Artist, actor, pacifist, and puppet maker, John Bromberg.
You know, I forget about things as soon as I do them, but then Trudy shows me something, and you know, I want to go back and develop that a little further. So I'm stuck in this rut, you know, of going back and forth.
you know
how it is, right, Larry?
Yeah, I do. That sounds very familiar. And you know,
you document everything.
I document a lot of things, and I have a great woman in my life too, who for some unknown reason loves me and you know, respects and appreciates me, even though I'm a selfish loon.
Wow, it's amazing for you to admit all of this.
I love you, man. I do.
All right, boy, Larry, this has been so this pandemic hasn't affected me personally at all, because I'm by nature a solitary.
Yeah.
You see, so I only go out to perform, and that's the only thing that's actually taken away from me. And actually, you know, I hole up in the winter. I actually go to sleep during the day in the winter, so that I'm not distracted by anything. That's when I concentrate on paintings.
Native and African American vocalist, songwriter, composer, and educator, Martha Redbone.
And the resilience, that's the celebration, is the resilience. And you know, those are words that people have said to me. So I, you know, and I like that word. You know, it's the resilience. It's like, you know, Maya Angelou's poem, "And still we rise, and still I rise." And those are such profound words. "And still I rise, and still I rise."
gift. Spinning star reflecting colored light on a snowy night by the fire. The next morning, homemade Cinnabons and dark roast coffee in a cup my daughter gave me as a gift that says, "Number one, Dad, tell me, what else needs to be had?" And there you have it, episode 401 of Troubadours and Rock On Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. Some of the best bits and wits of 2020 on Troubadours and Rock On Tours. I'd like to thank again all of the wonderful folks that were on this year's set of episodes. Truly privileged to be able to talk with you and to work with you. In particular for this episode, I'd like to thank, of course, and for the whole year, my associate producer, who I could not do this without, Dr. Michael Pavese, and our guests on 401, Sarah Cruz, Patricia Bosworth, JQ, Peter McGough, Surf William, Legs McNeil, Kitty Bell Burbank, Jerry Geddes, Martina Mayok, Glennis Johns, Nash Rose, Alan Jones, John Bromberg, and Martha Redbone, as well as these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Stretch, and Bobito with the M19s Band, Jenny Lewis, Terrence Blanchard, and Bramford Marsalis, too. And, of course, as always, from the bottom of my heart, I'd like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's do our best with this time. Take care.